Now, jazz is a comparatively recent part of the 100-year history of the Conservatorium of Music. It's the centenary this year, and Associate Professor Peter McCallum has written a beautiful-looking book, it reads very well too, about that 100 years. And I recorded a conversation with him on Thursday at the Conservatorium. Before we listen to it, though, let's listen to some music by Henri Verbruggen. Henri Verbruggen was the Conservatorium's first director back in 1915. He was also a composer, as well as a conductor and a violinist, and he wrote this piece, Under the Southern Cross, after he left Australia. Let's listen to a little from the first movement. It's called Dawn. So I'm at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music with Peter McCallum, who is Associate Professor here. He's the author of The Centenary of the Con, which is a splendid, big, heavy book which has just come out, subtitled The History of the Sydney Conservatorium, 1915 to 2015. Peter, the New South Wales government, why did they decide to established this place, which they claimed at the time was the only state-funded music school in the British Empire?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing to look at the history of the Con, I think. And what I really loved about writing the book was to see how, to me, the great waves of reform in the Con actually coincided with really significant educational reform in the state of New South Wales. And believe it or not, before World War One, just after Federation, there was a lot of educational reform. And for example, the whole teacher training process in New South Wales was completely reformed. Francis Anderson, University of Sydney, was scathing about the old state of reform. And the creation of the Con by the first Labor government of New South Wales was very much in that spirit. It was an educational reform. They felt that it was time that the the new country had a culture of its own, that there was more to it than making money, more to it. In fact, I think Carmichael, who was the influential minister at the time, says there comes a time in the history of a country when they want to get their head out of the hog's trough and learns that there's more to their culture than more to their personality than just the amassing of money. And then if you jump ahead, unfortunately after World War One, that confidence and energy to some extent receded in New South Wales, and also I would have to say at the con a bit. Then if you jump ahead to post-World War II, another extraordinary period of optimism, and really one of the most visionary people in Sydney's musical life, Sir Eugene Goossens, comes, has a fantastic tour in 1946 with the SSO, gives the Australian premiere of The Rite of Spring, which he'd also premiered in, given the British premiere of, and suddenly, as one correspondent to the Herald once put, Sydney became orchestra mad. But he got the joint job of chief conductor of the SSO and the Sydney Con. And again, there was this enormous energy about educational reform and music reform. I think the next big reform period I would cite is the Whitlam period in Australia. Suddenly the federal government said, hang on, we want to get our act together on higher education, we want to have standardised funding across the sector, and the con was a great beneficiary then under Rex Hobcroft, and a huge period of expansion, introduction of jazz, a whole lot of new courses. So to me, what's really nice about that founding, and it's bizarre that there in the middle of World War One, they went ahead with this plan to have a conservatorium, and it went extremely well, despite a lot of criticism from particularly the rural constituency, who said, well, why are we spending all our money on a conservatorium when we've got problems? And of course, with all Labor governments, they said, oh, profligate, you know, all they want to do is spend taxpayers' money and so forth. But in fact, it was a terrific initiative, and it did endure. Yeah.
Let's talk about the conservatorium's first important Belgian, which is the figure of Henri Verbruggen. We're standing outside Verbruggen Hall here at the Conservatorium of Music in Sydney.
Yeah. Well, Verbruggen was absolutely the right appointment. And I think it was probably by good luck and good management, to be honest. The original committee had thought, oh, we really probably need to push opera, because they, because of the fame of Melbourne and people like that, thought that opera would be the thing that most likely to take root first. Perhaps also assuming that operas didn't need to have quite the depth of musical knowledge that some others do. No disrespect to opera singers in that. But in fact, Verbruggen had no operatic experience, and opera was quite slow to get off the ground. But what he did manage to do was found a state orchestra within 3 years of arrival, which, according to all reports, was fantastic. He was obviously an enormously energising figure. People loved his performances, and he drew goodwill. I suspect he was actually quite politically canny, too. There are some quite nice stories, for example, when he wanted to bring his own quartet out, and people, there was a lot of resentment that he was bringing three more foreign people. And there was a very nice letter from Cyril Monk, who ran his own quartet at the time, and said, well, actually, I support him bringing this quartet out. I think this is going to be good for music. So I think, and the other thing Verbruggen did was handle the unions very well, because there was a lot of opposition to that issue as well. So I think he was just a brilliant administrator, as well as a brilliant musician, and very inspiring, and he got the whole thing off extremely well. It didn't sustain. He eventually left in 1922. I think the point was, having built the orchestra and the con, he'd built something which was bigger than either party had really reckoned with. That said, the Labor government were quite happy to go with both, have a state orchestra and a conservatorium. But then, of course, governments change, and perhaps that revealed a flaw in the original governance setup, that the con was very much part of the state government. So if there was a change of minister and the new minister had a new idea or didn't like, you know, carrying forward with the previous minister's pet project, well, it would fall away. There was no kind of arm's length from government at that point.
Did Verbruggen have a particular line that he wished to follow when it came to ways of teaching? Because, you know, if you put a lot of creative people in one building, there are going to be rivalries and intrigues, and a lot of that is to do with, you know, no, you don't teach the piano like that, you teach it like this, and there are schools of piano teaching and violin teaching. let alone composition teaching, which comes later. Did Verbruggen know which schools he wanted to promote?
Well, he himself was a product of the Belgian school, a pupil of Isai, but I suspect he had a much broader conception of what needed to work. I think he, frankly, just wanted excellent people here. He tried to hire a piano teacher. He did have Arthur Benjamin come out for a while, but then Benjamin left as soon as Verbruggen left, and that was a great shame because Benjamin was such an enormously talented pianist and composer, and it would have been great to have had him in the country in the 20s and 30s. So be it. I think Verbruggen did have a very keen philosophy, and I think one thing one has to credit Verbruggen with is the importance of emphasising early training. It was due to Verbruggen that the high school at the conservatorium became part of it. He spent a lot of time going out and talking to primary schools, teachers, and he also encouraged the brass band movement. So I think he had a vision for music education in a community and how you would build a musical culture out of that. Regarding a specific school, I don't think he was dogmatic. I think, if anything, he was quite happy to have people from the so-called Dzhetitsky school who were, you know, had a certain view about things, and people from the so-called Mathé school, which was another school of pianism. I think, frankly, how much of that actually survives in the great-great-grand pupils of those original founders is debatable anyway, because artistry, if it's doing what it should, an artistic education should renew itself. It should be always finding new things. Of course, that's, I suppose, the balance with education, isn't it? You do want to preserve traditions, but you want to encourage this process of continuous renewal. Yeah.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN Radio Australia and online. I'm at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music and talking to Associate Professor Peter McCallum, who's a musicologist. He's also a music critic for the Sydney Morning Herald. And he's written a book about the centenary of the Con, this building in which we are. A word about the building. I mean, anybody who doesn't actually know what the Sydney Conservatorium looks like, if you head up Macquarie Street towards the Sydney Opera House, you pass on your right, just before the Botanic Gardens, this castle, these turrets and crenellations, and in there is, well, that's where we're standing at the moment. Perhaps you could just fill us in on why it looks the way it does.
Well, it certainly is quaint, isn't it? Though I think that charm has been one that Sydneysiders have loved for many decades, indeed possibly centuries. Of course, the building was designed by Francis Greenway. He was commissioned in 1819 to build three buildings, actually, a government house, a fort on Bennelong Point, and a stables. Now, Government House wasn't built during Macquarie's period. It wasn't finished till 1845. The fort was built, and it also had a castellated edge, and then the stables were also built. But of course, they were stables to what? There was no Government House for a few decades. So for a while, they were sort of used for a variety of orderly type purposes. Then for a while, after Government House was finished, they were completed. But of course, with the coming of the automobile age, Fort Macquarie got demolished for a tram shed, famously, and of course then, in beautiful revenge for that act of philistinism, the tram shed was demolished to build the Opera House. So aesthetic beauty eventually won out on Bennelong Point. But the Con survived, and it was reformed, rebuilt in, they started in 1912, finished in 1915, and put a roof on it to make the Verbruggen Hall. Of course, the Verbruggen Hall was originally an open area. Underneath Verbruggen Hall, by the way, there are still remnants of a bakery, which, as far as our archaeologists can tell, dates from the very earliest days of the colony. And then Macquarie wanted this whole area to be gentrified and be the governor's domain, so he got rid of all the unsightly buildings like bakeries, and he made it into a parkland and a pleasure area. And it's retained that to some extent. I think, of course, then the building was then refurbished again comprehensively in the years 1999 to 2001. And the original building was preserved, but some wonderful other facilities were built around tunnelling sort of underground into the terrace in government, leading into the gardens. But
Let's wander along here. It's getting a bit noisy by this stairwell. Let's see if we can stand outside somebody's teaching studio where there's a bit of singing teaching going on. There have been some very famous students, of course, or people who've gone on to become famous, but there have also been some very famous teachers who've worked at the conservatorium over its 100 years. Could you maybe mention a couple of them, Peter?
Yes, well, you're right. There have been many famous ones, and I guess if one had to pick out a couple, the ones I would pick out, partly because of their influence on Australia's musical culture, would be, first of all, Alexander Zwierzynski, and he was a very interesting figure, but he was the teacher of, well, many pianists who are actually still on the conservatorium staff, like David Miller and Daniel Herskovich, indeed my own wife, Stephanie McCallum, also learnt from him, but also, very significantly, of course, of Roger Woodward. And Roger, when he then went on to Poland, all the teachers in Poland were astonished that Roger knew Scriabin sonatas. He knew a lot of the works of the Russian avant-garde from the 1920s. And they were actually learning things about their Slavic heritage from this chap who came from Australia. It's a very nice story about Zwierzynski when Gieseking, the great pianist, came out, and Gieseking wanted to put one of these Russian avant-garde sonatas from the 20s on a program, and the ABBC said, no, I don't think so. But then Zwierzynski got him to come and give a little private performance here at the Con. Zwierzynski was obviously a teacher of the sort which are not always healthy in institutions, and that he ran a sort of private little empire. He charged very high fees. He was extremely aggressive about making sure nobody got late in paying them, and he led quite a good lifestyle. But there's no doubt that he was a very fine teacher indeed, and he trained people to a very high level. He himself had been born in Latvia, of all places, and had then not liked life under the Soviet regime, had gone to China and then come to Australia in, I think, around 1922, and set up the Zwierzynski Players, joined the Con staff after a little breakaway conservatorium founded by Alfred Hill had started up and then failed in the old Parlings area of George Street. And as I say, he became a legend around the place. Just on the subject of teachers, I think it's probably a good idea to mention one other, and that is the great string teacher Robert Pickler. And again, he migrated to this country. He was Hungarian, happened to be conducting an orchestra in Indonesia in, I think it was about 1942, and the Japanese imprisoned him. So he was Jewish, so he probably was lucky to be imprisoned by the Japanese in Jakarta rather than the Germans in Hungary. But maybe there wasn't much in it, but he survived the war, though he did have some ongoing health issues as a result of that. But I think Pickler, you spoke earlier about schools of playing, and I think you really could say that Pickler founded a school of Australian string playing, which is still alive today. And I would say that, and I know people like John Painter and Lois Simpson revere, well, Lois, of course, was Robert Pickler's wife initially before they separated, but they remained on extremely good terms. And Pickler came to the Con, part of the Sydney String Quartet, and went on teaching. I know when I was a student here, I would go to lessons and everyone was in awe of Pickler. And yet he was very nice. But the quality of musicianship was quite extraordinary. He was both a violinist and a viola player. Goossens put him in the orchestra as principal viola, and then he came to the Con. But he founded, of course, the Robert Pickler Chamber Orchestra, which I think many people would see, I certainly would, as a predecessor of the Australian Chamber Orchestra, and I imagine Richard Tognetti would acknowledge that lineage as well. So I think there is a genuine tradition of string playing, string ensemble playing, which has survived to this day.
When did composition teaching begin here, in a serious way, in a formal way?
Composition had been part of the Con's teaching all along, but there weren't many. I think we have to mention Ray Hansen, but oddly enough, Ray wasn't formally commissioned to teach composition. He taught oral training, which he was very passionate about. I think it really got off the ground here at the Con when Don Banks was appointed. And Don Banks unfortunately died shortly after being appointed by Rex Hobcroft in the 1970s. And composition now is, I think, as rich as you could ever hope for, because as I think people know, in 1990 the Conservatorium joined the University of Sydney, and we now really have a combined composition school bringing the Conservatorium tradition with the tradition that had flourished for many years at the music department under Peter Sculthorpe. And they were quite different for a while, and I think bringing together has just created a terrific diversity. Graham Hare, who was head of composition, always valued eclecticism. He always wanted composers who didn't write like he did. I think it's fair to say that Peter was a great teacher and was a terrific encourager. But around him, he did build up a school which is affectionately, I think, called the Landscape School. And the bringing together of those two, I think, has created a great strength.
Yes, there's a huge variety of styles amongst the composers who teach here now, which is, I think, a very good thing. On the subject of composers who teach here, you mention in the book that right at the very beginning, one of the people who applied for the job as director of the Conservatorium, the first director of the Conservatorium, was the composer of Hansel and Gretel, Engelbert Humperdinck, and that at the time, 1915, it was, you know, considered not perhaps the moment to appoint a German because there was a war on. But there are other, I don't know whether they're urban myths or what exactly, but these stories about Ravel having applied here to be a piano teacher in the 1920s and Schoenberg having applied to become a teacher of harmony in the 1930s. Is there any evidence for this as far as you're aware, Peter?
I'd love to be able to say there was, because those would be delightful stories. Both Diane Collins, who wrote a very fine history of the Conservatorium, and I have been unable to trace any documentary evidence of either Schoenberg or Ravel. I know that Vincent Plush says he saw a letter signed by Schoenberg, but for some reason he didn't take a copy.
You'd think it'd be worth something, apart from anything else, if we had signed letters by Ravel and Schoenberg in the building.
It would be lovely to think. The other thread of composition, by the way, that I would just like to mention is the technology, because Martin Wesley Smith, of course, who came here also in the 70s, set up a very fine tradition of electronic composition. Interestingly, Bernard Hines, who was a director here just before, just after Goossens, was also flirted with the idea of electronic music, though obviously as a dilettante. But it was really Hobcroft who established the electronic music studio, and it's been a theme of a strand of our thinking here. And I think there actually is, I'd say it's a strand of our thinking since the 70s, and I suspect it's more of our future than any of us realise, because goodness knows where the Conservatorium is going to be in 100 years' time, but you'd have to suspect that technology is going to play a fairly major part in music making.
And jazz, because jazz came on the scene comparatively late in the con's history, that's now a thriving strand of what's done here?
Well, there's a lovely story that Don Burrows likes to tell of him being at primary school and a flute teacher from the con coming to his primary school, and they all got up to play a note. And he was able to get a perfect C sharp out of the flute on first blow, and he says that's what turned him onto music. Don, of course, was lobbied the Conservatorium. He lobbied Rex Hobcroft in particular to set up a jazz school, but he didn't want to do it himself. He didn't feel he had the background. He'd, after all, learnt by playing in nightclubs during the war and running away from the child inspection officers who thought that children shouldn't be playing. But the though he then was a very great leader of the jazz school after it had been set up. But it was Rex Hobcroft who brought it out, and he brought out a wonderful jazz player from America called Howie Smith, a saxophonist. Howie's still thriving in the States, and I corresponded with him when I was writing the book, and he had very fond memories of setting up this period. And look, there was a bit of a culture clash when we first set up jazz, but actually I think many of the people in the con were great jazz devotees. After all, Isidore Goodman, who was a pianist here and a classical pianist, but he used to go off and play in jazz clubs at night as well. I think there were many people who were delighted to see jazz here. What was great about...
And Don Banks as well.
And Don Banks, yes, indeed. And what was delightful, I think, about Howie was he actually brought a very innovative style of jazz. And it was, you know, this was in 72 or 3, somewhere around that. I have to check the exact date. And frankly, it was at a time when there was an awakening of the avant-garde. And Howie Smith, as well as playing with jazz players, would play with people like Roger Frampton, who were putting on performances of Cardew and Cage. So there was this terrific coming together of advanced jazz, but also traditional jazz, and the people interested in the more adventurous aspects of the avant-garde in the classical tradition as well. And I think that's what it was a great renewal for jazz, for classical music, and for the Con in general.
And finally, Peter, I mean, now there are, you know, conservatories and conservatoires all over the world, but Australia is the only country I'm aware of that has this institution called a conservatorium. Why do we have this Latin ending on the end of the word? Do you know?
I'd love to be able to give you an answer for that, and I don't know that I can, but it has always had that name. And of course, people like to call it the crematorium or the moratorium when they're feeling in a bad mood about it. But I think we have to blame Campbell Carmichael for that term. He did a study tour. Campbell Carmichael, by the way, was the Minister of Education. It wasn't actually his idea to set it up, but he was the driving force, quite an extraordinary person in many ways. He reformed education. He required Sydney University to set up an adult education area. He was passionately committed to educational reform. And he adopted that word. Where he got it from would be lovely to find out. I don't know, because the European model, which he studied quite closely, doesn't use that word at all.
No. And whenever you use the word overseas, people look at you strangely.
That's right, yeah. But I think Melbourne has used that term as well.
Oh, yes. We have conservatoria all over Australia now, don't we? Thanks to Carmichael.
Exactly, yeah.
Peter McCallum, thank you very much indeed for talking to me on today's music show.
A great pleasure, Andy. A great pleasure.
And I recorded that conversation with Peter McCallum at the Conservatorium on Thursday. The Centenary of the Con is the title of the book about the first 100 years of the Sydney Conservatorium. It's published by Allen and Unwin. And there's a website you can go to, Con 100 Years. Go to our website and you'll find the link. Today's music show is produced by Maureen Cooney and Penny Lomax. Technical production by Steve Tilley, Andre Shabanov, Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, and Joe Wallace. On tomorrow's music show, Roland Peelman will be talking about his life and times. He's been 25 years artistic director of the Song Company. That's coming to an end. And he's just beginning as artistic director of the Canberra International Music Festival, which actually started yesterday. We'll go out today, though, with music by another illustrious director of the Conservatorium, also the conductor of the Sydney Symphony Orchestra at the same time, and that is Eugene Goossens. This is the culmination of his great work, Apocalypse, the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, Sydney Philharmonia Choir and Soloists, conducted by Maya Fredman. Thank you.